Yeah, thank you, everybody. Okay, we're going to move it on a little bit. And for this first part of the section this afternoon, what I want to introduce is the effect, obviously, that mental states is going to have on cognitive processes. Again, needless to say, this is an important dimension, and the Buddha is very explicit about this, that any mental state that's arising is going to affect, as we've said right at the beginning, the way that we see the world, the way that we engage with the world. One of the things that he's trying to make very clear in some of these early texts is a lot of mental states become habitual. And we become habitualized towards them. And in a very famous passage in the text, which is in the Madhupindika Sutta, which for those who might know this text is in the middle-length discourses, the Buddha says this, and it's a very short passage. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. What one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of that mental proliferation, beset a person with respect to their past, their present, and present forms cognizable through the eyes. Okay. Sounds technical, it isn't. It's giving a very simple cognitive chain. Some of these elements that are spoken about in this, we've met already. So we've got the very simple process that's being spoken about. Now, it's a strange sort of way that these texts speak. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. What does that actually mean? Well, eye consciousness arising means simple awareness of visible objects. That's all it means. Yeah. Awareness of visible objects. The meeting of these three, and this is the important part, is what we call contact. Which is this Pali word, passa. Contact. The model that's been used by the Buddha is, in a sense, all of our senses, including our mental sense, are palpating the world. It's like we're touching them. You know, so that's the reason why he uses contact. Our eye, literally, just like the fingers touch this table here, our eyes, in a similar way, it's obviously a metaphor that's being used, our eyes palpate the visible. Our ears palpate the audible. And obviously our tongue, the gustatory. You know, so we're literally touching and being touched by the world in which we inhabit. And of course, constantly, our mental awareness of thoughts and feelings and perceptions is also a form of touching that's going on. Now this touching, to go back to what was being said this morning, is intentionality. This is the intention. These are the intentional objects. The visible objects, the audible objects, the gustatory objects, the mental objects. This is the content of our consciousness. Yeah. Out of those, in a sense, is a contact. And out of that contact, and this is again where we went this morning, very briefly, we get the arising of Vedana. Now, it's interesting the way the Buddha puts this in this term of the chain that he's speaking about, because up to this point, everything that's happening, the meeting, let's put it in his terms, the meeting of an organ, a sense organ, with a sense object, with a consciousness arising or an awareness arising, giving rise to a contact and a feeling, is all very impersonal. It's an impersonal process. We walk through the world in a sense is an enormous amount of experiences impinging on us, At this stage, with the arising of Vedana, this is impersonal. What happens, though, is we take this personally. Because this is pleasantness, remember, or unpleasantness. And we don't need to go any further. It's pleasantness or unpleasantness that's arising at that stage. What, of course, is then going to happen is we discriminate at this point. And so we get this out. I'm going to give you not the correct terms used in the Pali, but one might be more familiar to people who see this in translated form. We get a form of sanya, or discrimination, arising at this point. In other words, what one feels, one perceives. Yeah? So perception is occurring at this very, very point. That perception, of course, itself is not empty. The full term that's being used in the original language, I'm sorry to keep referring to the original language, but the full term is what's called sanya sankha sankhata, which actually means that there are traces of past formations of experience in our perceptual processes of the moment. Yeah? Does that make sense? I mean, the question, if one wants to be really sceptical, if that is the case, if there's always traces of past perceptions in present moment perception, am I actually perceiving something new? Yeah. In other words, or am I simply re-experiencing what I've already experienced? Yeah. Doesn't mean it has to be identical, but similarly in this process. That which we perceive, we're going to think about. Yeah. You notice how it's personalizing. I have perceived, I am going to think about it, and thinking here covers our full range of our cognitive faculties. It means fantasizing, it means literally rationalizing, it means also, as we're going to see in the next part, it also means obsessing about as well. And because the next stage that we get is, you know, we're going to think about it. Let me give you the Pali. Uttakati. We're going to think about it. Is then we're going to basically what's called, the term in Pali literally means to make manifold. We're going to papancha. It's a lovely word. I really like the word papancha. It sort of comes off the lips quite nicely. It's not such a nice experience, though. Now, this word actually has a root in the original language, which means to obsess. It comes from something called papanchati. Papanchati is an obsessional way of approaching things. So it's the tendency of mind to spread out. Yes. Ever had that experience? Yeah, where the mind literally spreads out, pulls in all sorts of experiences, goes round and round in circles. This is papancha, or one aspect of papancha. So it's very important to understand this process, because the Buddha is then going to claim in some other passages that we find within the text that if we get locked into this process, particularly this personalization process, then this becomes the shape of our lives. Certainly becomes the shape of our minds. Yeah, that's the phrase he uses. Yeah. If we do this and this and this and this, this becomes the shape of our minds. Yeah. Remember, we've been talking all along about world constructing. If we look at the basic process that we're really interested in, either as MBSR, MBCT teachers, or just simply Buddhist practitioners here, we're interested in dealing with this word, dukkha. Not just the word, we're interested in dealing with the experience of dukkha. Yeah. This tendency to find things unsatisfied, unsatisfactory, painful, yeah. Indicating all of those unsatisfactory states that we can go into in our experience. In a day, as I often say to groups like yourself, you know, as you said, this is not an abstract concept. I'm sure you realise that, you know, particularly if you're working with people, you'll see that dukkha isn't an abstract concept. But dukkha is vast. And here is a taste of dukkha. If you're sitting here now, right at this very second, and think about this, and if you want something changed at this moment, doesn't sound big, does it? This is not pain, this is not being in a state of suffering, as this word is often translated, but if you want something changed, seat isn't comfortable enough, it's a bit too hot, a bit too cold, would like to have had something else to eat, I might want to go to the loo, wish the person would stop whittering on at the front. If you want anything changed, that is dukkha. So it's not an abstract concept, it's happening right now. And this is happening again and again and again. And what the Buddha is saying, outside of the physical, unavoidable stuff that often happens to us, we are often creating this by reactive patterns. And reactive patterns, particularly linked here, this is really, really important, linked to the Vedana, linked to the hedonic tone of what is going on for us. So simply finding something unpleasant doesn't sound big, does it? Finding something unpleasant ramps up when put under the magnifying glass of the mind into something which is huge, often for each of us, and then sets in as a reactive pattern for much of our experience. What is the tendency, perhaps, what do you perceive as the tendency to do when we come in contact with the unpleasant? Anybody want to suggest what we do?
Push it away.
Yes, push it away, get away from it, move away.
Some people dwell on it, though.
Pardon?
Some people dwell on it.
Some can, that's another question entirely. I think that's an interesting point. And perhaps, we can look at that later on in the day. Because some people do, you can make an identity even out of it. But for most of us, in our ordinary, average, everyday, ordinary experience, we're pushing unpleasant experiences away. We're trying to move away from them. Notice what I say. On an average, every day, pushing away. So it becomes habitualized. It becomes habitualized, and then, in a sense, it becomes the shape of our approach to life. Because when we talk about the shape of our minds, we're talking about the shape of our approach to everyday, ordinary experiences. So the avoidance of painful experiences, which obviously was a primary evolutionary concern, when it's being looked at in relationship to just ordinary, fairly innocuous, unpleasant experiences, becomes a determining pattern in our lives that we run away from everything that's unpleasant. Equally, if it's a pleasant experience, we will find ourselves gravitating towards it and moving towards it. So if you think about this, this represents a very unfree existence. Being attracted towards that which is pleasant and moving as far away from possible as that from that which is unpleasant. And we're doing this on a daily basis, consistently, moving backwards and forwards in a habitualized, almost ritualized way in our daily lives. So this cognitive chain is giving us an understanding of how certain forms, I won't say all, but certain forms of dukkha are generated and perpetuated. Because I hope you can see also that the avoidance of unpleasant experiences and the gaining of pleasant experiences is a fairly self-defeating exercise. We were never going to get all the pleasant experiences we want and avoid all the unpleasant experiences that come to us. It's called life. I'm tempted to say, get used to it, but that's what happens, isn't it? It's life. Life is that mixture of the pleasant and the unpleasant. However, when it becomes habitualized in this way, taken up, thought about, proliferated, the proliferation can even take the form of rationalizations of why it's a very good reason why I don't want to do that. It can even have a connection, although I haven't got time to explore this at the moment, into our emotional basis, so that Vedana becomes in some ways also implicated in the generation of certain forms of emotions as well. So this is the basic cognitive chain. Now you can see this is again the way that we build a world which is actually full of quite a lot of dukkha in different ways. This sense of unsatisfactoriness. You know, I cannot control, as I'm sure you can't either, cannot control all of the conditions of my existence. You know, if we said earlier on, there's so much coming to us outside of ourselves that I can't control, I have no control over. And this is an awareness of what is going on cognitively for us, and why, of course, that when this becomes habitualized in the way it does, it becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy of gaining dukkha repeatedly and repeatedly. Now there's one particular term that this repetition takes in Buddhist thought, in Buddhist psychology, and I'm using this as a psychological term, is this term, samsara, which really has to do with repetition. It literally means wandering round in Pali. Or, if you want to put it even more graphically, going round in circles. Yeah. Ever had that experience? Yeah. So it's that sense of repetition which is implied in this cognitive chain that gives rise to the repetition of a certain tonality to our experience, which is basically dukkha. Chris?
Well, in a sense, just to highlight how the raisin exercise graphically enacts this, doesn't it? So, you know, even contact with the thought of raisins we see in our classes or in our experience can set the cognitive chain going. But certainly, you know, someone has a raisin in their hand and there's contact, seeing it, there's an immediate evaluation of pleasant, unpleasant. Yeah, not as a thought matter of opinion, but this almost this a sort of somatic sense of pleasant and unpleasant. And then we see the perception creeping in our raisins. And as John said, when that faculty of sanya is activated, that's when memory comes in. So, you know, just the sight of the raisin, or they hold it under their nose and smell it, and there's a perception, isn't it? And memory comes in. Ah, you know, Christmas, or school lunches, or all sorts, that, as we know, when we've led the raisin exercise or been part of it, all sorts of stuff gets activated and associations. And then quickly, we find ourselves involved in papancha, don't we? Thinking about and making connections with, and actually we've lost contact with that little thing in the hand, and I'm living in my sort of habitual memory of raisins. It's informed by, you know, countless past experience. And all of that is being invoked. And so this sort of cognitive cascade happens just, I mean, it's part of what's so exquisite about the raisin exercise, isn't it? Because we see immediately how this, what John has been describing, is what carries us away. What takes us into autopilot. Particularly this word papancha, this proliferation, spreading out like a net, is one of the images. I love some of the other ways in which papancha can be translated: complication, exaggeration, elaboration, distortion, obsession. And we can see how that's what happens, isn't it? And probably those who've either been in a mindfulness class or taught one will have had participants in the classes who really get reactive around the raisin, you know, either internally or externally. And one can see the papancha process rolling on. And in a sense, you know, the Buddha uses the word ni papancha, so no papancha, the ending of papancha, as a synonym for nibbana. So that capacity to be with experience without the proliferation. In a sense, that's the portal into freedom, where I'm not even calling it a raisin, There's just the contact. There may be there will be the Vedana, but there isn't the getting on the train of associations that carries me away. And all of that as training and preparation for that ability to be with all sorts of other experiences, with in a nipa-pancha kind of way, a way that doesn't carry me away. So, you know, the contact, as I was saying earlier this morning, the contact with low mood, or with an intrusive thought, or a flashback, a memory. Contact, it'll have a Vedana to it, which may well be unpleasant. So easy in relation to that, then to get busy with perception and memories and associations and, oh, this low mood again, or that horrible mental image, or, you know, that worry coming back. And the reactivity to the unpleasant Vedana of it, yeah, triggering the thinking and then the proliferation, I'm back here again, or this is just so scary, or that would be so horrible if that happened, or, you know, all the ways in which we get busy, sort of, Papancha has this sort of, it's almost like yogurt or something, isn't it, that sort of proliferates and multiplies and just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows in the way that thought and association does, doesn't it? You know, and we think about our dramas so quickly, that the patterns of associative thinking that invoke memory and old patterns of reactivity, and just it spreads out so fast, doesn't it? And so helpful to be clear that what we're learning in this practice is compassionate equanimity. So an equanimity that can be with, for instance, the unpleasantness of a mental image, or a thought, or a body sensation, or a low mood, without getting on that train of association, without getting busy with papancha. You know, that can, in a certain, I just feel more and more that, you know, equanimity is, it's sort of equanimity with our own minds that is the sort of almost the most crucial aspect, isn't it? Equanimity with the thoughts that this mind produces, with the worries that this mind produces, with the difficult moods that it produces, as well as with the body sensations that it produces. And that it's to see that it's in the reactivity that launches us from a Vedana tone, which, as John said, is morally neutral, if you like. It's just inevitable that the Vedana tone comes. The equanimity that can respond rather than react, to use the language of MBSR, you know, that can feel the pull of the old habitual aversion and avoidance, and choose a different path. You know, choose to feel the feet or feel the breath, knowing that that mental image or that mood or that fear, that memory, will pass like it arose. It will pass. And that's where we develop that opportunity to choose. You know, the Viktor Frankl saying about between stimulus and reaction, there is a gap. You know, between contact, fassa, and or vedana, the stimulus, the vedana in a sense, and the reaction, which could be the sanya and could be the perception, and could also be the craving, the tanha, the pulling in the stuff we want, the pushing away the stuff we don't, is that gap. And that cultivating that gap is where, as Frankl puts it, our growth and our freedom lies. So really to have that clear sense that what we're teaching, what we're practicing, what we're teaching in mindfulness, whether in a Buddhist context or in MBSR, MBCT, these sorts of programs, we're practicing that capacity to be with a wider and wider range of experience. If you like, a wider and wider range of intensities of Vedana, without the old habitual reactivity kicking in that takes us down familiar paths of proliferation and exaggeration and obsession. And that's where the freedom lies. You know, it's not about having different memories. You know, it's about the relationship with them. Does that make sense? You know, I think when Jack Kornfield says this path involves giving up all hope of having a better past. It's part of what he's pointing to, isn't it? Because it's the hope that, you know, rather like John was saying, the point about dwelling. You know, well, we dwell with the unpleasant. Well, you know, helpful to remember that understanding of rumination as being... Rumination is often trying... See if this is how you experience it. Trying to get rid of, trying to avoid, I'm trying to think my way out of that painful set of memories. Because it's the problem-solving mode of mind that, because we're human beings, kicks in and tries to work out, well, why did that happen? What did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? What does this mean about me? What does this mean about my future? And so rumination is trying to sort of solve the problem or solve the unpleasantness of a painful memory. You know? So in a certain way, it's a cognitive avoidance strategy. Which is why, you know, in the exploring difficult practices, the invitation is to drop the storyline and sense it in the body and work not with the papancha aspect of it that will just keep the whole thing alive, but actually to come to the immediacy of the somatic aspect of it, where there is the possibility to build a different relationship with that experience. If you like, to practice giving up all hope of having a better past. You know. I'm conscious there's lots of experience in the room, and so apologies if this is just repeating stuff we all know, but I just find it helpful to keep reminding myself that, both sort of conceptually and experientially, because that clarity of intention about what is it we're doing when we're teaching or practicing mindfulness, you know, the clarity or lack of clarity of that will affect every meditation we lead, every inquiry we lead, as well as every meditation we do. You know, that a compassionate equanimity with the stimuli of pleasant and unpleasant Vedana, where we let the dance of them change, is in a sense what we're really trying to encourage.